Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Gail Harrison for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 2 weeks before elections in Iraq, the U.S. and Iraqi government say the election will happen on January 30th. No delays, no matter how bad the security situation is. But the White House this week has also signaled that Americans shouldn't have high hopes about the outcome of those elections. Joining us from Washington is Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, nice to have you back.
Nice to be with you.
You've been writing about this week. Tell us exactly what the White House is saying now and how that has changed.
The White House has begun lowering expectations of what will happen in Iraq and the importance of the election. They're saying that rather than being the big major milestone and the barometer of whether Iraq can achieve democracy, the election is instead just the beginning of a year-long process, and that, in fact, the more important elements will be the writing of a constitution, which will begin later this spring, and another election at the end of this year for a permanent government.
I also noticed in your story yesterday that the really significant comments seem to be coming from sources who wouldn't allow themselves to be named. Why are they being so delicate about this?
Well, the White House has a policy when they give briefings of not naming the officials who are actually doing those briefings. That's been a consistent policy of this administration. But the most interesting line out of that briefing was when the official urged us not to get involved in a numbers game in the Iraqi elections. In other words, if there is a very low Sunni turnout, as many now expect, not to see that as a sign of failure. They're saying that the mere act of holding this election is the real key to its success, and that whether or not the majority of Sunnis participate is not crucial.
Is it your sense overall that the White House has had these concerns for quite some time now and is only now making them public, or is this just putting the best possible spin on the situation as it is right now?
Probably a bit of both. There's been growing concern about the problems, the mounting insurgency, the walkout by one of the key Sunni Muslim parties. But I also think it's to redefine what victory is.
Well, exactly. And with members of Congress coming back now, having been in their districts and heard public concern, is there a feeling of the election as perhaps the time to declare democracy and come home?
Well, the United States is in a bit of a hole when it comes to bringing U.S. troops home. The problem is, unlike any war the United States has been engaged in for the last 60 years, since World War II, really, the U.S. can't afford to walk away. We could in Vietnam in terms of there was no broad rippling impact on the United States, but the impact of walking away from Iraq on the war on terrorism, on stability in the most important economic geostrategic region, on the price of oil that would affect our industries and our economy, the impact would be so huge that there has to be some alternative if the U.S. is not able in the next few months to begin restoring order and countering the strength of the insurgency.
And Robin, finally, what do you make of the comment from this unnamed administration official that just because there's low voter turnout, we've had that in U.S. elections, that doesn't mean that this is not a real election?
But that really isn't a fair comparison. What if all American Catholics or all American Protestants, a whole ethnic or religious group, was, or all people from New England or all people in Texas were excluded? That's kind of equivalent. You can't exclude a whole block or not have a whole block participate in an election. So it's a little bit different. It's apples and oranges.
Robin Wright, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Robin Wright is diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. We turn now to Borzoo Deragahi, a freelance reporter for The Boston Globe. He joins us from Baghdad. Welcome, Borzoo.
How are you doing? Good to speak to you.
Let's start with the security situation. How bad is it right now? Because we hear of these attacks, but there on the ground, do they feel a little remote, a little isolated?
No, actually, they don't feel isolated at all. It seems to be quite a specific pattern, quite a concerted, specific, strategic effort on the part of insurgents to target very specific people, such as public officials, security officials, election workers, people running for office. And we also, you know, just as the press corps, we feel that we're getting a pass at this point, just for now, because they want someone around to document their atrocities. And we're fairly certain that at any given second, if they decide that they don't want us around anymore, we'll be on the list of people to be targeted.
Mm. Well, speaking of that, we read recently that one group is claiming it will post snipers outside some polling stations. Do you know who's making that threat, and are people taking it seriously?
I don't know. There have been a lot of threats like that. There was a group called the Secret Republican Army, and they said that in Dikar province, which is in southern Iraq, they had posted several dozen snipers to attack anyone who votes on voting day. I'm not so worried about what's going to happen on voting day. What's more disturbing is the lack of protection for people after voting day. So let's say you live in kind of a rough neighborhood and you decide to fulfill your civic duty by going and voting. What's going to happen to you a week later when the poll worker gives the list of people who voted to the insurgents? Or, you know, a day later when someone who's spotted you voting decides to firebomb your house? That's really the thing that scares a lot of people. Maybe the Americans and the Iraqi forces will be able to secure the country for one day, you know, on election day. What happens after that?
Well, good question. And because of that, are people feeling terrorized, or do they seem to be pretty determined to go to the polls anyway?
I think that it depends on who. It depends on which Iraqis. I know that Iraqi Kurds up in the Kurdish, autonomous Kurdish north of the country, they're psyched to go to the polls. They're psyched to exercise their newfound political freedom. I know Iraqi Shias, for them, this is a big celebration. Their top spiritual leader, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, has issued an edict, a fatwa, saying that it is your religious duty to vote. This is a historic opportunity for Iraq's Shia, who've been oppressed for many, many centuries, really, to assert their political power and sort of take a dominant position in the country over the minority Sunni Arabs.
Let's turn our attention to logistics for a moment. Who is actually running the elections? Is there an Iraqi election commission?
Indeed, there is an Iraqi independent election commission. They're aided by the United Nations, as well as a few NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And they're out there, and they're working hard. You know, there's a 5,000 or 6,000 employees already. That number could increase to as many as 200,000 on election day, as people are hired to staff the polls and monitor the polls and so on. They're having quite a bit of trouble finding staffing because of the inherent dangers of the job. Already at least 7 Iraqi election workers have been shot dead, killed, and many are worried that there will be more in the coming days. The people who work in the election commission are very secretive. No one tells anyone what they're really doing. It's a very interesting job.
And what about the small picture logistics? For example, are ballots printed yet? Are there ballot boxes that have been warehoused and you know, ready to go into action? Are there election workers who know what they're supposed to do and are willing to do it despite the danger?
I think that there are election workers who know what they're supposed to do and are willing to do it, and they are out there doing things. As for the ballots, they keep telling us that they're in the process of being printed, but I haven't seen one yet, and I've asked almost every other day for the past week if I can get a copy of the ballot. Ballot boxes, I don't know. I assume that they've gotten started on that.
And in terms of politics, Borzu, what are the big issues this election beyond Yankee go home?
That's a good way of putting it. You know, it seems like every single party has the same agenda, you know, security, prosperity, and independence, i.e. getting the Americans out. But no one is really specific with their programs. They seem to rely on sort of feel-good advertising or, you know, posters that have pictures of Ayatollah Sistani on them. And, you know, there's a little bit of fear tactics. I think many of the parties have, like, front parties that do their dirty work for them. Like, for example, Alawi has he won't ever say anything nasty about any of the other parties, but he's got this other party, which is, you know, members of his government are in it, and they are, like, out there. They're, like, sort of his attack dogs. It's really kind of Karl Rove-ish. They go out there, and they'll attack the other list, saying, oh, no, these guys are a stooge for Iran or a stooge for Syria, and these people are, you know, spies. They're not worthy of your vote. And then Alawi will sort of distance himself from it. You know, it just had a very familiar ring. Indeed, in the past few days, we've noticed the sudden arrival of these old Stratcom guys who used to be the spinners during the Paul Bremer days, you know, and they're arriving and they're here and we're asking them, what are you doing here? Like, we're here to advise the government for the next 3 weeks, basically. So basically you have these sort of importation of Western campaign advisors that are very familiar to us, the Baghdad Press Corps. We remember these guys from before.
In terms of the Sunnis, are there any Sunni party names on the ballot, or is there a complete boycott?
Well, I think there's a real distinction to be made between the secular Sunnis and the more pious Salafi, Wahhabi fundamentalist Sunnis in the countryside. And there are a number of Sunni leaders on the list, but they're all, you know, the secular ones. You know, for example, Adnan Pachachi is a Sunni. This gentleman I spoke with this morning, really nice guy, Hatham Mukhlis, is a Sunni. He's from Tikrit, Saddam's hometown. Nasser Kamal Chaderchi is comes from a very famous family of secular Sunnis. And these guys are running. You know, these guys are sort of old school Iraqi Sunni Arab nationalists. And they have, there's even a few parties that I would term neo-Ba'athist, in that one of their platforms is kind of reconciliation with the country's Ba'athists and so on. Those more secular people are running. What you don't have, and what's really disturbing, is any representative for the more pious, more Islamist Sunnis running in this. You did have the Iraqi Islamic Party, but they withdrew from the elections. And that was a very, very big blow, I think, because that was one way to channel those energies. And now the only other channel for them is, like, possibly the resistance.
You gave us some names of some of the people who are on the ballot. I wonder, are there candidates who really stand out? Anyone who truly looks like the future of a stable, democratic Iraq?
Well, one guy I really like, and I thought he was really interesting, was this guy. Hopefully you'll hear more from him and about him. He's a former Mahdi Army associate. Now, listeners may remember Mahdi Army as the group that was led by rebel cleric Muqtada Sadr that went out and fought the Americans. And this guy, his pen name is Fatah al-Sheikh. He ran Sadr's house newspaper. And he has since taken off his keffiyeh and put on a suit, and now he's running for office. And I think that's really interesting. That's, I guess, the best of what could come out of this political process is people who were militants, people have a gripe. They roll their sleeves up and put their hands out and start shaking hands with constituents and start building political movements.
Borzu Deragahi is a stringer for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Baghdad. Borzu, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Anytime.
Just ahead, President Bush goes to Florida to talk about jobs and higher education. But is a college degree really worth it? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. President Bush is visiting Jacksonville Community College in Florida today to highlight the value of higher education and job training. Like President Clinton before him, Bush touts a bachelor's degree as a way to earn more money and help boost the economy. But many economists are wondering whether a college degree is as valuable now as it used to be, something the parents of high school seniors are no doubt pondering as well as they gulp at astronomical tuition costs. Well, joining us on the line is Cecilia Rouse, who teaches labor economics at Princeton University and is director of the education research section there. Welcome, Cecilia.
Thank you.
Well, people who keep track of these things are telling us that approximately 30% of Americans hold college degrees. Given that, can we say that a college degree is as valuable as it used to be?
Absolutely. The economic benefit to going to college is as high as ever. What has been reported recently is the fact that while there were huge increases in this benefit to going to college during the 80s and early 90s, the rate of increase has slowed down. But the fact is that the benefits to going to college are as high as ever.
How do you account for that difference then? Why is it slowing down?
Well, it's something that we're still studying, but the best guess is that in the 80s, a lot of the reason why the benefit to going to college was so high was because if you didn't go to college, the penalty was so high. So that is the fact that the wages of earners who just had a high school degree or less were actually decreasing. And what we've seen in the mid to late 90s is that their wages have been increasing, which means that the gap between the wages of those who go to college and those who do not has not been increasing as fast.
Well, very often these days, if you talk to the parents of high school juniors or seniors, some of them look at the tuition costs and say, good heavens, you know, I could take $200,000 and just give it to the kid, let him start a business, and he'd probably be fine.
And some of them would be fine, but it's a much riskier way to go.
Well, the other piece of this equation would be the value of a high school education. Has that increased?
Well, that is that, and that's the piece that's really moving, I think. So in the late 80s, that was decreasing, so it was definitely a good idea not to just stop with a high school degree. Today, it looks like employers are valuing the skills of high school graduates a little bit more, but the fact is that in the United States, at least, one is still better off going to college. One thing to keep in mind is that if you look globally, and we've become much more of a global economy, most workers in the world have lower years of education. So that means that high school graduates are competing with workers all across the world. And so, sort of globally speaking, one is still better off getting more schooling.
Is it fair to say that you could earn a decent living just with a high school education these days?
The wages of high school graduates are still low.
Mm. When you talk about the value of a high school education, there's a lot of testing now of high school graduates. Has that increased the value of a high school diploma? In other words, the graduates now from high schools do have more skills than they used to?
That's something we're still studying, which is how beneficial these accountability systems are for students in terms of the labor market and their future education as well. But my understanding is that some employers may be saying, look, we know that these students who just have a high school degree have passed these proficiency exams. We think they have some skills, and we're willing to compensate them for them.
Well, let me turn it now to the sort of opposite spectrum then from a bachelor's degree. Some parents are worrying that even a college degree isn't enough these days. Is a master's degree what a bachelor's used to be in terms of the income that it will produce?
The rat race in education. It's probably true that if you want to distinguish yourself from the numbers of people who have bachelor's degree, which is still only about 30% of the population, having higher degrees will help do so. I think that the biggest difference is between those who have a bachelor's degree and those who do not.
Okay. A great deal of government money has been poured into job training, and there are some who argue that perhaps a better government approach would be doing more than job training, that perhaps we should be raising the minimum wage or supporting unions.
Absolutely. In fact, there's good evidence that part of the reason why there was increasing inequality in the late 80s and early 90s was because of the falling value of the minimum wage. So there's no doubt about that we need to find ways to shore up the wages of lower-skilled workers, and I think job training can be part of that package.
Well, and finally, closing the loop here on the question about college educations, some are more expensive than others. Is it worth paying the money for a truly expensive college education?
The million-dollar question. Believe it or not, we economists don't absolutely know the answer to that question. There's some very compelling evidence that suggests that good students who could get into the Harvards and Princeton and Columbias, it doesn't really matter which school they go to if they went to a less expensive school, Rutgers University, for example. And so, in other words, that the reason why it looks like the students who go to the high expensive universities do better is because really those students are just very able students to begin with. But there's some other evidence that suggests that it does matter which school you go to. So I think I will leave that to the parents.
Cecilia Rouse, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Cecilia Rouse is professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. It isn't often that a president of the United States talks about what he regrets, even when asked. President Bush was criticized last year when, during his second debate with challenger John Kerry, he was asked to name three instances where he had made the wrong decision, and he declined to specify any. Well, now he has apparently thought of a few. In a roundtable with journalists from 14 newspapers, President Bush said he regrets two of his most famous expressions, "bring 'em on," and that he wanted to take Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Bush used the expression "bring 'em on" in the summer of 2003 after declaring an end to major combat operations in Iraq. This week, he told the roundtable reporters that tough talk like that can have unintended consequences, that he was really just trying to rally the troops. He also said that First Lady Laura Bush chastised him for saying in the week following 9/11 that he wanted Osama bin Laden dead or alive. He told reporters it was just an expression that came out. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Typhoons in Japan, hurricanes in Florida, and now the destructive tsunami in South Asia. The loss of life in the past year has been massive due to natural disasters. The loss of property, too, has been extensive. How has the insurance industry coped? Lord Peter Levine is chairman of Lloyd's of London, the world's largest specialty insurer. He joins us here in the studio. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Lord Levine, you spoke to insurance professionals in Boston this week about some of the challenges that the insurance industry has faced in the past year. And I also understand that you were in Malaysia at the time of the tsunami. What did it feel like being there at that time?
We were very, very lucky. I was on the beach there with my family, two sets of married children and three grandchildren. We were hit by the tsunami. We were hit by the water. We were on the beach. We had to run away. But we got off relatively unscathed with a few scratches and cuts. We were only 100 miles away from Bandar Aceh, and we were only 150 miles away from Phuket in Thailand, where so many people were sadly killed. It was pretty scary at the time, lasted about 10 minutes, I suppose. It's not 10 minutes I'd like to have to go through again. But we were very lucky.
Well, and also from the perspective of an insurance industry professional, it, I assume, had to make you reflect on how can the industry prepare for something on this scale?
Well, I think if you see these terrible pictures that we've all seen on TV for the last couple of weeks, you'll realize that, in fact, very little of that property was insured. It, you know, they're pretty simple dwellings, and a lot of people, but and not ones that go in for insurance in a big way. Some of the hotels would have been, but for the insurance industry, I don't think it's going to be turn out to be something which is going to cost an enormous amount of money. But how do you prepare for them? It's difficult. If you compare it with what happened in Florida, it's very different. In Florida, you had four hurricanes one after another, which is unheard of, but for everyone, there was several days' notice. You knew when it was coming. You had a report every day. It's coming to the left. It's coming to the right. You could know if it was going to hit you, and you had plenty of time to get away from it. It might damage your house, but you'd be okay. Earthquakes aren't like that. But nonetheless, it's known. It's well known, especially the Japanese know this, which is where the origin of the word tsunami came from, that if there is an earthquake, then it does tend to create a tidal wave if it's in a coastal region. And you can forecast pretty well where that's going to go. The problem in this particular case was that they never had one in that area before, so they couldn't forecast it. Some natural disasters, as I say, hurricanes, you've got good warning because you can see them. Earthquakes, very little warning. You can take all sorts of physical precautions. In California, which is earthquake prone, there are many buildings which are built specially with reinforced foundations, as indeed they are in Japan, in Taiwan, and other places. But certainly, having come into this industry as I did from the outside just over a couple of years ago, at that time, just after 9/11, everybody was talking about terrorism. How do you protect against terrorist attacks? And I was saying, look, terrorist attacks, of course it's a terrible problem. Everybody's worried about it. But don't forget about natural disasters, which historically have always accounted for far more damage and caused far more harm than terrorist attacks have done. And unfortunately, I was right.
Well, as you say, in terms of the impact of the tsunami, for insurance purposes, these were many fishermen and you know, not a huge impact there. But imagine if something like this on this scale happened to, let's say, the east coast of the United States. I mean, is it possible to insure for a disaster on that scale?
Well, you can insure for many things. And what we do, the east coast of the United States, let's talk about Florida because that's, you know, where these things do happen. We run what we call realistic disaster scenarios, which talk about a major hurricane hitting Dade County in Florida. Now, if it did that, where it's very built up, a lot of very valuable property, we have to ensure that our underwriters who cover those areas are sufficiently well funded to be able to meet those claims if they come. So the simple answer to your question is yes. If you say, where is the limit? Of course, there is a limit. If, however, you say, you asked a more difficult question, perhaps, which might be, had you modelled what would happen if two jumbo jets were hijacked by fanatical terrorists and flown into the World Trade Center, the answer would be no, because nobody believed that such a thing would ever happen. Now, very sadly, we know differently. And the fact that the U.S. government have joined the industry in forming a system under which disasters of that scale can be handled, and it's sadly a problem which we've had in the UK for far longer than in the US with all the terrorist attacks we had there years ago, it can be dealt with. And I know this is something which is in place until the end of the year in the US, and I'm sure that the industry and the government will come up with a suitable follow-on system for that. So I think within reason, yes, the industry can cope with it. After 9/11, the results for us in 2001 were very bad because we had to pay out all the money. 2002 and 2003, we had extremely good years. But that's not just us lining our pockets. That's making sure that the funds are there for when another problem arises, such as the four hurricanes in Florida at the end of last year.
One of the things that you have called for is for the insurance industry to become more transparent. What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, as you know, Mr. Spitzer has become very concerned with some of the practices in the insurance industry.
Mr. Spitzer being Elliot Spitzer, New York's Attorney General.
Exactly. And there has been a practice with brokers who take a sort of overriding commission, which is not illegal and which was well known, but it was not made clear to policyholders, particularly major corporates, as to where the total cost of their insurance, and by the total cost, I mean the brokerage cost plus the actual premium themselves, how that was divided up and what they were paying, what they were actually paying for. We believe that that information should be made very clear. That's what we're calling about for transparency. And I hope that one good thing that may come out of those investigations is the fact the policyholders will know much more clearly how much they're paying, why they're paying it, and who's getting paid, and then they can decide for themselves, as they do in any other commercial decision, whether they're getting value for money.
Lord Levine, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Lord Peter Levine is chairman of Lloyd's, the world's largest specialty insurer. Still to come, how the hippies of the 60s became the SUV drivers of the 80s. You're listening to Here and Now. The Washington Post reported today that the Christian missionary group World Help has now dropped its plans to place 300 Indonesian Muslim orphans of the tsunami into a Christian children's home. The Indonesian government has long-standing objections to orphans being adopted by those outside their faith, fearing that Muslim children would be forced to convert. Meanwhile, the government has declared that all foreign soldiers must leave the country by March 26th, all of which raises the question, when does welcome international aid wear out its welcome? Well, joining us on the line is Henry Rosemont, who has taught ethics in international development at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And, Professor, let me ask you first about this flap over World Help. Is this a situation that could have been avoided?
Probably, but it would have taken an awful lot of reflective thinking and trying to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. I think it's possible to be altogether well-meaning and actually provide some help and yet to do the wrong thing. The way to appreciate that, and the more general question you're asking about when does humanitarian aid stop, is to just imagine another tsunami or another hurricane devastating Florida, which is, of course, still recovering from the four it had before. And knowing that our National Guard and Reserve is stretched very thin because of our preoccupation with Iraq, the Mexican government offered to send 10,000 soldiers to set up a base camp and to relieve the horrors being wrought in by the tsunami or the hurricane. Then imagine the Muslim American community saying, we will adopt orphans from there, trying to do the right thing, and as well as to polish our image in the United States. My strong sense is that neither of those would take place. President Bush would not allow the Mexican troops, or the French, or even the English, for that matter, onto United States soil. And we'd be very upset about Muslim American communities gathering together to raise the Christian children.
What are some of the other issues that aid groups and foreign governments in particular need to keep in mind then when they go into other countries after a disaster, however well-meaning their efforts?
Well, first, there are a lot of things. There, I think it is possible to decide what the right thing to do really is, but it is complicated even within a single culture or country like our own. Abortion, stem cell research, gay marriage, and so on show that very clearly. But when you're going into another culture, you start dealing with not only issues of your domestic laws, but the domestic laws of the country that you're going into. You're thinking of international diplomacy, of politics, issues of religion and culture. All those matters have to be kind of taken into the mix before deciding what's the right thing to do.
Does it make any difference whether a disaster is natural or man-made?
Yes, there's, I'll say, a little less politics involved. That happens that the Americans went into Aceh province, which was one center of civil unrest in Indonesia. But, just try to imagine if the British and French governments in 1864 had said, we want to offer humanitarian aid to all the Georgians that suffered at the hands of Sherman as he marched from Atlanta to the sea. I strongly suspect that Abraham Lincoln would have said, no, thank you. It's that kind of thing. Because had there been a natural disaster that took a great part of the South or the North, Lincoln may well have let them in. I don't know.
And there's another factor here in terms of these religious groups in particular. Many, if not most, if not all, are tax exempt. So is there an issue here in terms of government subsidizing what may be a proselytizing effort?
Yes, that's part of what I meant by the taking the domestic law into account as well. I gather that World Health put on a fundraising plan for specifically for these orphans and specifically on the basis of converting them to the Christian religion and making good Christians out of them. And I have no problem with making good Christians, but I don't know that American tax dollars should go to subsidize that kind of effort. And I'm sure a lot of people would agree with me, including a large number of Christians.
Henry Rosemont is a visiting scholar of religious studies at Brown University. Professor Rosemont, thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Glad I could help. Anytime.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. A classic cartoon from the New Yorker magazine depicts the revolutionary Che Guevara wearing a Bart Simpson T-shirt. Irony, perhaps, or just a sign of changing times when counterculture goes mainstream. Think rebel chic. In the new book, Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture, Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter take a new look at what counterculture really is. Their conclusion, it's not a threat to the system, it is the system. Joseph Heath joins us from the studios of CIUT at the University of Toronto. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Gail.
Well, with apologies to folk singer Pete Seeger, where have all the rebels gone? Are you saying there's no such thing as counterculture and possibly never has been?
We think there are definitely countercultures. The question is simply whether the counterculture represents a threat to the system. You know, the standard story is that, you know, the reason you get Che Guevara T-shirts and so forth is that the system is extremely good at co-opting the counterculture. And so things start out revolutionary, but eventually they get diluted down and sold back to the masses as consumer goods. Well, what we argue in the book is that basically this theory of co-optation is a myth, that what's going on actually is a kind of competition amongst members of the counterculture to kind of show how rebellious they are and to stay ahead of the pack.
And in fact, you point to the 60s at the hippies as being entrepreneurs as well as consumers, and then they turned into yuppies. So make the connection for us. How did a hippie driving a VW Beetle turn into a yuppie driving an SUV?
Well, it's not an accident that San Francisco is the home of both the $3 latte and the $4 sourdough. The counterculture scene was always intensely entrepreneurial, mainly because the goal of a lot of hippie consumption was to prove that you're not a victim of the system. And so if the big automakers are trying to sort of brainwash you into buying a new model every year, one good way to rebel is to go out and buy a Volkswagen Bug, you know, which shows that, you know, you're not fooled by the system, right? So that's kind of rebel consumerism. Now, obviously, once you get kids, a VW Beetle is no longer so useful. But still, you don't want to drive some boring old, you know, station wagon. So what do? Well, you buy, you know, an SUV with off-road capability because, you know, the man tells you that there's this thing called a road and you need to drive in a straight line down this road. But if you're the real rebel, you got to be able to veer off anytime you want and kind of make your own road. I mean, that's the rebel sell. And it can be used just as effectively to sell, you know, Ford Explorers as it can VW Beetles.
The illusion of freedom, at any rate. Well, in the 70s, then, there was punk rock that became a movement, swept across Great Britain and then filtered into America. But when the rebels get together and become a movement, whatever you want to call it, is that when Madison Avenue starts stepping in?
It's not as though advertising and Madison Avenue sort of stepped in at some point. It's just that the counterculture was always a marketing opportunity, and the do-it-yourself scene always produced new businesses. And so within a couple years of the punk scene emerging in Britain, there were designer safety pins for sale in the chic London boutiques. Is that co-optation? No, it's just that everybody, when they consume, they're looking for a way of expressing their individuality and establishing some kind of distinction. And one of the best ways to establish your distinction, to prove how cool you are, is to show that you're a rebel. And so anything that's rebellious automatically is going to attract a lot of interest. But then, of course, you know, once the masses start buying it, it no longer works. It's no longer rebellious to have a safety pin. You know, you have to do, you know, something more extreme. And so the counterculture itself generates cycles of obsolescence as people have to go always further and further, always buying something new or doing something new in order to prove that they're not one of, you know, a member of mainstream society.
And hence, as you point out, the despair and ultimate suicide of someone like a Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, we start the book talking about that. It has resonance for me because he was exactly the same age as I was. And his basic problem, he had a lot of problems, but one of his basic problems was that he thought of himself as a punk rocker, somebody in the business of making alternative music. And so obviously that creates a problem when millions of people start buying your albums. So he was constantly haunted by this idea that he had sold out, even though it didn't seem to him that he had sold out. But nevertheless, right, the failure was just to recognize that there isn't such a thing as mainstream and alternative culture. There's just, you know, stuff that's popular now and stuff that people haven't found out about yet.
Well, and indeed, it was so ironic to read in the book about how they tried deliberately to lose fans by putting out an album, which was horrible, but in fact, everybody loved it.
Yeah, one of the things we pointed out is that Lou Reed did this a long time ago with his album Metal Machine Music, the ultimate alternative album, because it was basically a double album of nothing but absolutely unlistenable white noise. That's how you lose fans. You know, so all of this was already done in the 60s, and that's one of the things that we really try to emphasize in the book is, you know, this countercultural idea has been dominating, I mean, not just fashion and politics and music, but also has been dominating people's political ideas for 40 years. And yet, clearly, it's not working. It's not generating the kinds of positive social and political change that people want it to, because every generation seems to fall into exactly the same pitfalls that the previous generation fell into. You can see with contemporary hip-hop how people are repeating a lot of the same mistakes that were made by punk rock, that were made in the 1960s.
Well, you mentioned politics. Does that mean then that there's really no point in becoming politically active? Because if you do, you just become another ad target and another consumer group?
Oh, quite the opposite. What we argue is that if you want to do politics, you've got to actually do politics. The problem with the countercultural thinking is that it convinced a lot of people that doing culture, you know, forming a garage band or doing drugs or doing what, you know, whatever the case, that was politics. We actually have a very old-fashioned view of politics, which says that if you want to actually do politics and if you want to improve society, you need to focus on legislative change and you have to do all the boring stuff, licking envelopes, you know, making phone calls. That's real politics. And that a lot of the fun stuff that got promoted by the counterculture as politically radical isn't actually subversive or radical at all. All it does is generate more consumerism.
Hmm. Well, let's turn to teenagers growing up today. How hard is it for them to rebel, and are they even inclined to? Because they seem to be a very obedient group of consumers.
Well, one of the things we found with the book is that we found young people to be very receptive to this idea, because I think that now it's very difficult for anybody to believe anymore in this difference between alternative and mainstream, or to really believe in counterculture, partly because information travels so quickly now that everybody who wants to find out what the latest cool trend is can find out within a week or so. So, you know, back when I was young in the 70s, in order to find out what was going on in, like, say, the London punk scene, it actually required an enormous amount of effort. And so you actually could have underground cultures because most people didn't have access to the information. They didn't know what was cool. Whereas now, you know, kids log onto the internet and they can find out instantly what's happening anywhere in the world. And so what happens is this, you know, quote, co-optation is almost instantaneous, right? I mean, anything that shows up on the radar as the latest sort of hip, cool underground phenomenon that has anything to recommend it whatsoever instantly becomes mainstream.
And so once the cool people make something popular, everybody does it, and then the cool people need to move on to the next thing, whatever that is.
Yeah, and that's, I think, really important to recognize that cool has a competitive logic. And so when people criticize consumerism as status competition, there's a sort of very routine way of condemning it, where we think of a 1950s suburb with, you know, white picket fences and a shiny Buick that they park in the driveway. It's really easy to condemn that kind of status competition. The way we compete with one another is cool. I mean, what's cool? That's the central status hierarchy of contemporary urban American society. I mean, I just sort of look through my own stuff and think almost everything that I spent too much money on, I bought because I thought it was cool. Right, so that's really what's driving consumerism. It's also what's driving a lot of status competition.
Joseph, thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Joseph Heath is co-author of the book Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture.
Come as you are, as you were, as I want you to.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Minigon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Karen Miller-Medson, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our newscast producer is Matt Largie. Our intern is Danielle Dreilinger. And we bid a fond adios to our web producer, Will Thompson, who's on his way to Mexico. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Gail Harris. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.